from the book The Open Door of Emptiness by James Lowe. Chapter 1, Getting to Know How We Are, Part 2. Finding a Method That Works for You, Deconstructing Our Assumptions, and Seeing Things as Real and Being Attached to Them. Finding a Method That Works for You. Having got to know ourselves a little bit, we start to know what our real problems are, so that when we talk about the five poisons, anger, desire, stupidity, jealousy, and pride, these are no longer just general concepts or interesting things to think about, but we recognize ourselves in them. We know our own patterns of stupidity. We know how our own desire ties us in knots. We know the kind of situations we get pissed off with. At that point, when we know ourselves a bit and we have some clearer understanding of who we are, we can have some clearer understanding of Dharma. We can start to fit ourselves, our particular karmic shape in this life, into the menu of potential that is the Dharma and find the best possible fit. It is useful if we have a teacher who knows something about the Dharma and also something about us, so that they can give us some guidance on that fit. The kind of advice we need from a teacher will change as we know more about ourselves, as we know more about the Dharma, and as we know more about the fit. At first, we are very dependent. But as we get to know more, we can be more independent. And we can then have a kind of consultation with the teacher to get more understanding about where we understand ourselves to be. Let's revisit the word Buddha. Buddha is translated in Tibetan as Sangye. Sang means purified. All obstacles and difficulties are removed. Gye means rich, full, complete, spreading out all good qualities. So the more we know ourselves, the more we know the things that have to be purified or removed. If we are a very angry person, or a very jealous person, or very stupid, or proud, or don't do the practice. Whatever our own particular pattern is, we can have a sense for ourselves. What is our next task? If I have to work on my anger, what is the best way to do that? Now that we know what Buddhahood is like, we realize that we have these problems that we have to get rid of. Since we have read that Buddhahood is free of anger, jealousy, hatred, and so on. If I am a very lazy person, for example, although I keep having the thought that I'd like to practice the Dharma, I often feel tired, or I need to go to bed early, or at the end of a busy day, I just want to watch television. In the morning, I've got to rush to work, because I don't like to get out of bed early. In this way, it is never the right time for doing Dharma practice. Now, I might be able to motivate myself to do something by thinking about death, by thinking that my life will end, that I don't know when it will end, and that it might end very soon, and that if I die now, I will have achieved nothing. Oh my God! I better do some practice. I could reflect on impermanence and death and use that to frighten myself. I could use fear to motivate myself to meditate. However, perhaps I grew up in a family where my parents were often trying to frighten me into activity, and so I have grown resistant to fear. If you don't do your homework, then you won't pass your exam. And you won't get to college, and so will never get a job. Look at you. You will be like these jobless people sitting on the park benches. So get on with your homework. It's a very dangerous world now, and only your education will protect you. For people who grew up hearing this sort of message, frightening yourself into meditation will not work. For some people, meditating on death does motivate them, but if this method does not work for you, then it makes sense to use another line of thought. For example, you might think, well, if I practice the Dharma and I purify all my bad karma, then I will never have to be born again in a household where I have to do homework every night. If you understand yourself a little bit and understand something of your own karmic habits as they reveal themselves in your past experience, you might decide that this approach suits you better. Both are just methods to get you motivated to practice the Dharma. And once you know more about yourself, you can start to find what is a good fit for you. You can see what is effective in getting you mobilized and what depresses you and takes your enthusiasm away. A big supermarket sells all sorts of food, but if I have diabetes, many of the things are not food for me. They are poison. So, although all of these things are classified as food, many of them, such as jams and cakes, are actually poison for me. They are not a fit. So method is very important, and nobody else can really tell us about that. Even if I am a diabetic and my doctor tells me what not to eat, until I have eaten that food for myself and experienced the consequences, then I do not really appreciate how this food is now a poison for me. It may not have been a poison for me when I was younger, but now it is. Sometimes we eat something and we don't like the taste, but actually it is good for us. Other times we eat something and we don't like it, and it's not good for us. It can be difficult to know the difference, which is why it is important to talk to teachers, to read, to reflect on what we read and hear, to talk with other practitioners and try to think together about what is going on. Why is it that this doesn't seem to help me? Is it because I'm being resistant to something? I tell myself that I want to change, but it seems that actually I don't want to change. I know that if I really do this practice, it will change me. Is that why I don't do it properly? Because I don't want to change. Is that the story? Or is it the case that this practice doesn't fit with me just now? That's why it makes sense to do some of the preliminary practices, Nondro, and through that to recognize the ways in which we may sabotage ourselves. Some people, for example, are so greedy that they want the best thing immediately. I want only to do Dzogchen, the highest practice. But they don't understand Dzogchen, and because they are full of greed and pride, they feel ashamed at not understanding it. So they pretend they understand and keep up this pretense for some years until finally they drop the whole thing. It's very important to learn how we sabotage ourselves. If we know a lot about that, then Dzogchen can make a lot of sense, since the main practice of Dzogchen is to be able to dissolve the points at which we self-sabotage. In fact, that is the real essence of Dzogchen. When we visualize a ball of light, or Padmasambhava, or Tara, or any other deity, we are trying to have the sense of it as transparent. We are seeing it, but in the moment of seeing it, we want to have the recognition that this is simply an image, like the quality of image that you would get in a mirror. What we're trying to do is to have the sense of colours organized into particular shapes that resemble the form of a deity, Pambasambhava, Tara, or whoever, with their specific ornaments and robes, but all of that being light. You have form or shape, but no substance. Our habit is to think that when we see something, there is actually some substance there. But what we're trying to do in tantric visualization sadhanas is to see something while knowing that there is nothing there. But it is not that there is nothing there at all. Nothing is appearing as something, just as when you look in a mirror and you see something, but you can't grasp it. There is nothing to grasp. There is no substance to the reflection in a mirror, and yet it is there. I hope you can see how this is very important and how it links in with the purification of relative truth, because you are purifying the notion that when you see something, there is something there. This practice is saying, no, every time I see something, nothing is there, but nothing is revealing itself as something without the something becoming something as such. This is very important, and it is why an intellectual understanding of emptiness is also very important. Deconstructing our assumptions. The heart of our practice is allowing the deconstructing of the habit whereby we perceive substances as existing in truth, as being really there. I am holding up a match. When you look at it, what can you see? You have all seen matches before. You may even have used them many times. When we look at it, it's a match. We can see a wooden stick with some coloured chemicals on the end. This exists, doesn't it? This is definitely a match. It's not a magician's illusion. Here is a match. Now, I'd like you to watch this match very carefully. What is happening to the match now? James lights the match. Where has the match gone? The idea of the match may return, but this particular match itself will not return. When we see the match, we forget that the match is made up of substances which are held together due to the presence of particular conditions in the environment. Matches are manufactured in a particular way. We are used to opening the box and seeing matches looking a certain way. Maybe with red heads, maybe blue heads, but anyway, looking roughly like this. In order for the match to exist like this, many thousands of millions of conditions have to be in place. There needs to be a planet. There needs to be a habitable climate on the planet. There need to be the things that have developed through time to grow as trees. There needs to be people who plant the trees, who fell the trees, people who make the metal that makes the saws that cut the trees. There need to be vehicles to put the trees on. There need to be boats to put the trees on. There needs to be a factory where this match was made and cut up very small. There needs to be a whole petrochemical industry that makes the chemicals on the head of the match. There are millions and billions of factors resting in this one thing. This item, this match, holds the whole world together. So many billions of factors have brought this into existence in this room at this time. And then all sorts of other factors will lead to its destruction and where it will go when it goes into the rubbish. It is moving through time, held in place in its particular momentary form as a meeting place of causes and conditions. I think that it's very important to remember this when we look at something in our usual way. Oh, it's a match. Somebody asks us, "Have you got a light?" It's very automatic. We see this item existing in itself, and we don't see the whole incredible infinity of circumstances that have to be in place for it to exist. Its existence is a dependent existence, without the least inherent existence. The same applies to everything else. It applies to our own bodies. Think how many complex factors have created and sustained our bodies as they are in this room at this time. Just think of the position your body is in, and all the things that cause it to be in that position. Habits, maybe not being used to sitting on a cushion, maybe being tired at the end of the day. All sorts of factors are involved in our posture. To return to the example of the match, in relation to Buddhism, what is important is the sense that if this match is existing here as the momentary coming together of all these causes and conditions, then it has no essence in itself. There is no matchness in the match. It is simply the play of an infinite multitude of factors. If we change the causes and conditions, we actually change the thing. If we let the match get damp and then try to light it, it is a bit difficult because water doesn't burn, matches burn. What other use do we make of matches? Only for burning. When it is wet, it doesn't burn. But if we dry the wet match, then, because the causes and conditions of the heat are greater than the water will dry off, so that the basic quality of this particular combination will reveal itself for a moment when it is lit. Having burnt itself out, it burns no more. As a further example, supermarkets display food in different ways according to the susceptibility of specific foods to changes in temperature. Some food is kept in a freezer. Some is kept on an open shelf. So here we have a beautiful fish. But if it is not kept cold, it starts to go off. And we think, oh, I don't really want to eat this fish. It's not so fresh. When we were small, we maybe had a drawing book or a first reading book with a little picture of a fish and the letter F for fish. Then one day Mum says, "Tonight we have fish for supper," and she cooks it and puts it on our plate. Now we seem to know what a fish is. But a fish is lots of other things as well. Fish is this biochemical composition which disintegrates under certain circumstances. Once the fish is killed, the energy recycling force that was keeping it healthy and fresh is cut off, and a new process starts, which is the process of rotting and corruption. So what we have to do is get the fish out of the sea and into the shops and onto our plates as quickly as possible before this other decaying process takes place. Otherwise, ugh, I can't eat that. It's the same with the ego. It is held in place by circumstances. Somebody says, "You're no good at this," and the ego deflates. Somebody says, "Oh, you're so wonderful," and your ego expands. Due to causes and conditions, we change our shape. Yet we imagine that we are essentially the same person. Usually, we act as if there were a true essence or a self-substance to the things that we see and to ourselves. But in fact, what we have is a ceaseless play of the infinitely complex interplay of causes and conditions, bumping off each other and transforming. What we take to be an existent, a being this or that, is actually part of the ceaseless process of becoming. This is why contemplation on impermanence is so important, as a means to keep us in touch with the dynamic, moving nature of the world, watching how things form and unform according to their interplay with the environment. With this practice, we can start to get a conceptual understanding that, although we perceive something, there is nothing there other than the play of forces. We have the erroneous belief that there is something with inherent existence. It is this belief that is to be deconstructed through the meditation. Seeing things as real and being attached to them. Attachment is the quality of impure relative truth, the second and more dense aspect of relative truth. We develop our attachment to something that does not actually exist, and then invest it with value according to our own proclivities. So here we are, sitting in this meditation hall, saying our prayers to Pambasambhava as the manifestation of nothing. Nothing, nothing, please come here and get rid of something. It might seem quite mad to be trying to turn all the richness of the world into nothing. However, the fact is that it has always been nothing. Form and emptiness. Sound and emptiness. Everything and emptiness. The tantric method is to be as devoted as possible to this something which is nothing. Ordinarily, we take each thing to be something. Padmasambhava, the precious guru, Guru Rinpoche, is the divine apparition, the illusory form who makes contact with our illusory forms, so that we can see that our self-identity has always been an illusion. Through merging with him, we come to see nothing as something and something as nothing. When you have attachment to something as something you like, such as a nice watch, you will have a similar attachment to something as something when you go to the doctor and he tells you that this lump you were concerned about is cancerous. Then you think, something is something. And I don't want this something. Get rid of this something. We free ourselves from attachment by developing faith and devotion. The traditional texts say we should have such devotion that the surface of our skin is rippling, the hair stands up on our neck, and tears run from our eyes. We cry out in desperation, "You who are nothing, come and save me from the delusion of something." This is the purification of attachment through the application of attachment to nothing. It may sound a strange thing to do, but remember that the reason for us doing this practice is to recognize that suffering arises from attachment to delusionally reified nothing. If we can turn the focus of our attachment onto nothing rather than onto something, then nothing, nothingness, emptiness, openness, radiance, will become the most empowered object in our world, and it will then be able to antidote our attachment to imagined somethings. To practice this transformation, try to visualize the open, clear blue sky. Arising in it is a ball of shining light, or the form of Padmasambhava, or any other deity you wish to use. Visualize this as clearly as you can, as the manifestation of light, in a form which appears to be something, but which is actually nothing. The true essence of Padmasambhava is emptiness. This is the Dharmakaya nature, infinite emptiness. Focus on Padmasambhava and recite the mantra Om Ahung Benzaguru Pemma Siddhi Hung. Be aware of your own thoughts and feelings. Be aware if you are making this image too strong or weird or distorting it in some way. Try to stay with the visualization, recite the mantra, and relax, free of any thoughts and feelings that are covering it over. Do this with devotion. Padmasambhava, you are the essence of all the Buddhas. You represent whatever is enlightened in the world. I have total faith in you as the radiance of nothing. At the end of doing this, this form comes to the top of my head and dissolves down into a ball of light that goes down through the top of my head into my heart. My body then dissolves as light. During the practice, rays of light have been coming from Padmasambhava's three places into me, filling me with light, which dissolves all traces of my body as a substantial entity. My body is now a light body. The Guru, as a ball of light, comes into my heart. My body of light dissolves into that ball. So now, subject and object have come together. There is just one ball of light. You have the sense of going in and just dissolving. And then there is nothing. Gradually, through these rays of light that were coming from Padmasambhava into me, I have gone from being something as such into something as nothing, into the radiance of light. Then the something which was nothing, the light form, has itself dissolved into nothing. And out of that nothingness, something arises. Thoughts, feelings, images, color, whatever it is. It is at this point that we want to recognize that all that arises is the form of Padmasambhava. That is to say, it is something as nothing and nothing as something. Whatever is arising is actually nothing, just the play of nothing. We don't need to be attached to it or frightened of it. We don't need more of it or less of it, because it is just nothing. It's just play, like clouds in the sky. After some time, you will become aware that your mind is wandering off after some thoughts. This is when you can focus on the thoughts in order to recognize that the nature of all thoughts is ungraspable. By becoming conscious of what distracts you, you can see the ways in which the five poisons are operating through you, and the ways in which you are most likely to let them sabotage your ability just to relax and be open. Gradually, the forms that are arising for you manifest in the familiar forms that are around you. At that moment, keep the clarity that whatever is arising is nothing as somethingness of nothing. If your experience starts to get a bit solid and you find lots of thoughts are arising that are pulling you back into seeing something as something, you can briefly close your eyes and imagine everything dissolving back down very quickly to nothing, and then just let it arise again. You can repeat that dissolving, arising, dissolving, arising, and keep softening the tendency to turn something as play into something as something. This is one method for integrating the two truths in our meditation practice. From the book The Open Door of Emptiness, a collection of public talks and teachings by James Lowe. Read by Wendy, October 2024.